Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of November 9th. This week we spoke with Robert Ellsberg, editor at Orbis Books, and also the editor of The Duty of Delight, The Diaries of Dorothy Day. In this week's issue, we have a special article by Dorothy Day that's never been published before called Our Brothers, the Jews, and in honor of that occasion, we thought we would talk with Mr. Ellsberg, who is now editing the letters of Dorothy Day. We began our conversation by asking Robert how he first got to know Dorothy Day and become involved in the Catholic Worker movement.
I went to the Catholic Worker in 1975 after taking what I intended would be a year's leave of absence from college, and I had intended to stay there just a few months. But ended up remaining for 5 years, and after a few months, no more than a few months of being there, Dorothy asked me if I would be the managing editor of the newspaper. That's one of the things that inspired me to stay on so long. But I met Dorothy within a few weeks of being there at St. Joseph's House on East First Street, and she was, you know, in her late 70s at the time, and considered herself in retirement. Most of the work and the responsibility was in the hands of people she called the young people. But she was, of course, had such an aura about her of authority and experience. And she was, of course, the main reason I'd been attracted to the Catholic Worker. And so meeting her at the age of 19, I felt my initial impression was of just being very intimidated. But she was a very approachable person and took a great deal of interest in people and where they came from and trying to kind of to help them discern their vocation and what their gifts might be. She considered the Catholic Worker a kind of a school. She didn't expect people to stay there forever, but a place where people might come to discover what they wanted to do with their lives. And it certainly had that influence on me.
Now, you have since continued some work. Obviously, you edited the Diaries of Dorothy Day, which came out earlier this year, I believe?
Last year.
Last year, okay. And now you're working on the Letters of Dorothy Day. How did that develop? How did you go from working there to kind of working on some of her letters and diaries?
Well, when she died, just after I returned to college, I conceived the idea of editing an anthology of her selected writings, which I did, and was published, I guess, in 1984. By Knopf and then reprinted by Orbis. I came to work at Orbis 22 years ago, and in those years I had continued to work a lot with books by Dorothy and about the Catholic Worker. I've reprinted several of her books and published even an unpublished biography of Peter Morin that she left, edited a book of the Catholic Worker Art of Fritz Eichenberg, and many other books by and about Dorothy. So I considered my work here in some ways a continuation of that editorial work that began many years ago. And her personal papers were sealed for 25 years after her death, according to the agreement she'd made with her in leaving her papers to Marquette University. And in 2005, they contacted me and asked me if I would serve as the editor of her diaries and letters. And so I've been working on that for the last 4 years. The diaries were published last year, The Duty of Delight. And I hope next fall the letters will appear. I'm just about finished working on that now.
Maybe we can start with the diaries. As you were going through the diaries, what were some of the surprising things you encountered that you didn't perhaps know about her?
By and large, the voice in the diaries is very consistent with the, you know, the Dorothy that people know through her writing. She was a very personal writer, and she drew a lot on her you know, her diaries and her everyday experience in the kind of writing that she did. But what I guess some of the things that struck me were the discipline of her spiritual life, which, you know, should have been obvious in a way. I mean, she's a very faithful, practicing Catholic. But it was striking in reading the diaries to see just how much her daily life was organized around her spiritual practice, getting up at dawn, you know, fasting before going to early morning mass every day, saying the rosary, reciting the office, and that sort of thing. So that was striking to me. I also knew, of course, that she was very close to her daughter, Tamar, and her large family. Tamar had 9 children. But I was interested to see just how much she was involved in their lives. A lot of people think of Dorothy as somebody who left family life, you know, far behind when she founded the Catholic Worker, and whose life maybe didn't have much in common with the life of ordinary people in a family. But she really was a person deeply involved with her daughter and her grandchildren. And I was even struck by the story that wasn't familiar to me about how in the 60s she went up to Vermont and lived with the grandchildren for 4 months while her daughter was off getting a nursing degree. And so you see Dorothy Day, whom we usually associate with picket lines and fasting and demonstrations and that sort of thing, you know, just driving kids to football practice and doctor's appointments and helping them with their homework and scolding them and getting exasperated with their rock music and that sort of thing. So a different kind of picture of her humanity and her connection with ordinary life comes through there. There were other stories that were not so familiar to me about the leave of absence that she took from the Worker in 1942. She intended to take a year off, but it only lasted 6 months. And she spent that time pretty much living as a kind of hermit and actually contemplating leaving the movement altogether. She had become kind of exasperated with the whole thing and wondered whether she was doing any good and whether it was just too much of her own ego involved in it. Eventually, she decided that was her life and her vocation. She went back and never left again. There was also a striking story that was unfamiliar to me. She never wrote about it. About in 1959 and 60, that winter, the father of Tamar, of course, her Batterham, she writes about in The Long Loneliness, the man she had loved and had left after her conversion because he wouldn't get married to her, contacted her, and the woman he'd been living with since then, a woman named Nanette, was dying of cancer, and he asked her if Dorothy would come and take care of her, which was a pretty astonishing story. Dorothy dropped everything and moved in with him for about 6 months, caring for this woman until she died, and actually baptizing her the day before she died. Those were some of the stories that were, you know, not so familiar to me. But what really just comes through mostly is a sense of the spirituality that was expressed in ordinary everyday life, day by day, trying to be more patient and more forgiving, more self-critical of her own faults, the kind of discipline of just struggling day by day to grow more deeply in love and charity, and that as being the kind of foundation for a life that made it possible for her to do so many more striking and extraordinary things on the stage of history.
Yes, I was just talking about the Duty of Delight with some of the other editors here yesterday, and one of the things they pointed out was that it was striking to them how scrupulous she was, how self-critical she could be. For somebody who is, you know, her calls for sainthood has been proposed, or is at least being pushed by some, did that surprise you how self-critical she was at times?
Yeah, I think that it was, I mean, everybody who knew Dorothy, you know, knew that she was not, you know, without fault. She had a temper. She could be judgmental. It was interesting to see how conscious she was of those tendencies in herself, and she'd write very frankly about her loss of patience and her tendency to be flippant, not be sensitive to other people's feelings, to lose her temper, to be judgmental. And I think that, you know, her spirituality was very much influenced by Thérèse of Lisieux, the little way. And of course, you know, Thérèse in her autobiography writes about the path to sanctity that comes from just being forgiving and more patient when another sister splashes, you know, water in her during the laundry or something like that. Little small things like that Dorothy took very seriously. I mean, she went to confession every week, and I expect that she felt she had quite a lot to confess. That is one of the things that really comes through in the diaries, is the way that she, in writing about her day-to-day life, kind of treats her life as as a spiritual journey, as a pilgrimage, as she, you know, described it in her column. Every day was an arena for the struggle for toward holiness, not just the great, you know, heroic kinds of things that she did.
And when you first read the diaries, was there anything in there that you thought, wow, this is quite personal? Maybe this isn't something that you thought, well, maybe this should not be included? But if so, what did you finally decide to do?
Only a few things that I omitted on the grounds of discretion, where she's describing kind of personal details about her physical ailments and that sort of thing, that I thought it serves no purpose for everybody to read everything that she wrote down. But there was nothing there that I felt reflected, you know, badly on her, that I felt, oh my gosh, this would destroy her reputation or anything like that. I wasn't put in that position. In reading her, I'm editing her letters now, and it presents even a more complex picture of Dorothy, because she's not just writing to herself over and chronicling her daily life, but it reflects relationships with people, and you see different aspects of her. And even there, in the letters, you can see her capacity to be judgmental and angry, to be hurt and a little petulant, and yet usually you would see that in subsequent letters, efforts to apologize or atone for that in some way. I think all of that is important, and I wouldn't dream of trying to airbrush anything, you know, out that might detract from, you know, the complexity of her humanity.
Who are some of her correspondents? These are letters from her entire life?
Well, again, it's not comprehensive in the sense that we only have access to the letters that people have, you know, donated to the archives. She must have written. You know, tens of thousands of letters. She spent hours every day writing letters, whereas she only spent, you know, often just, you know, 15 minutes or less writing in her diary. What we have is just a very small percentage, and yet I think it's fairly representative of both, you know, the kind of friends of the Catholic Worker, family members, general correspondence to people who would write in with questions or concerns, but also to, you know, close friends and people that she had a deep relationship with over many years.
And in terms of the letters themselves, was there anything that you've come across so far that it has surprised you or given you a different picture of Dorothy?
Probably the most striking thing, and this will, you know, I'm sure be the occupy most interest in reviews and reflections on the letters, is the correspondence with Forster, Tamar's father, which was never available to anyone before, and her biographers had never seen any of this before. It really does add a very new chapter to her biography. These are letters that she wrote to Forster before the Catholic Worker, and we're fortunate that they are among the most extensive number of letters from that early period. Most people, you know, probably didn't keep letters from Dorothy Day back then, but Forster did. And after he died, he gave them to, they went to Tamar, and then eventually to the archives. So no one has really read these before. They show, first of all, kind of the story of, you see Dorothy in love with this man that she's just crazy about. And they are extremely touching and moving. But they also then document the story of what happened after her conversion and their separation. From the long loneliness, you kind of get the idea that she made this fateful decision for God rather than man, and that was kind of, it was painful, but that was sort of the end of the story. But in fact, the letters go on for another 6 years. She did move away, went to California, Mexico, Florida, various places, partly just to be far away from him, because she had such overwhelming feeling of attraction to him that she felt she needed that kind of distance. And all that time, she is trying every way she knows how to persuade him to marry her. So it wasn't like that was the end of the story after her conversion. Her dream and her hope, desire, was that eventually they would get married and she would have this, they would have a happy family life together, have lots of children. And of course they didn't, and largely, you know, his choice. And one can only, you know, imagine how her life would have been very different, and probably no Catholic Worker at all. But it's striking that the last letter to him is in December of 1932, where she says, basically, okay, I give up. This is never going to work out, and I just have to accept it and move on. And that is the very month that she met Peter Morin, who inspired her to found the Catholic Worker. And so it's almost as if one door is closing and another is opening. And you can almost see Dorothy moving right there from this crossroad, one path in life that she was her dream. And then that's closed off, and she moves in a completely different direction. And the letters after that and the early years of the Catholic Worker seem to reflect an utterly different person altogether. There's much less sense of the continuity, between her as a kind of progressive activist Catholic and, than you might get from reading her memoir, that might, seem as if she was just in kind of waiting there for the right occasion, but basically her kind of instincts joining social justice and Catholicism were kind of there. There's no sign of that in the earlier letters. It's just she was writing novels and mystery stories and kind of potboilers that weren't getting published. And then suddenly she's the leader of a lay Catholic movement and involved in, labor issues and social struggle and founding a, House of Hospitality in the Bowery and the publisher of a newspaper. And it's quite extraordinary. You think, where did this person come from? It's one of the kind of mysteries and the extraordinary aspects of her story.
Finally, maybe you can just discuss the fact, here's somebody who lived in the 20th century with, we know a lot more about her than perhaps we do other saints or would-be saints. What does her life tell us about what it means to be kind of a holy person in this day and age?
Well, she represented a kind of holiness that was very much in the world and very much engaged with the social challenges of the 20th century. She was not a product of, a convent or of any, traditional kind of religious community. She represents somebody who simply read the Gospels and decided to try to live them out in a spirit of that was shaped and formed very much by the social challenges of her time, beginning with the depression and unemployment and homelessness, the hunger that was part of that time, but that then very quickly took up the question of violence and war, civil rights, the threat of nuclear weapons, issues of freedom and conscience. She was, in some ways, anticipated so much the kind of perspective and the spirit of Vatican II, but also anticipated aspects of social Catholic teaching that were not articulated for decades later, including kind of the option for the poor, you might say a sort of seamless garment approach to issues of life, issues of conscience, her ecumenism, her kind of demonstration of the fact that holiness is not just for the few and not just for priests and religious, but was a vocation for all Christians. I think, those are some of the gifts, the particular lessons that she offers to the Church, and I think that, canonization, properly speaking, is not like an honorary degree or reward for a life well lived or something, but it's calling attention to, new ways or patterns for embodying the Gospel that speak to our time and challenge all of us to find our own path to holiness, and I think that is the extraordinary gift that Dorothy offers just through these diaries, showing her humanity and the fact that her holiness was so much expressed through these kind of day-to-day actions. As you say, we know a lot about her, not just through her own writings about her, but through the diaries here, we have a very unusual opportunity to kind of follow in the day-by-day, hour-by-hour footsteps of a holy person. And I think that walking with her through this book is an extremely moving and inspiring experience.
Well, Robert Ellsberg of Orbis Books and the editor of The Duty of Delight and the forthcoming Letters of Dorothy Day, does that have a title yet, or is that still being worked on?
My proposed title is All the Way to Heaven.
All the Way to Heaven, okay. Well, we want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
I want to thank you for joining us for this week's podcast. Hope you visit online this week, where we have several features, including a review of the film Bright Star, a slideshow of the work of Vasily Kandinsky, an honorary review this week we have in the print edition by Leo O'Donovan of a show at the Guggenheim. Finally, we debut this week our first of what we hope will be a weekly feature. A video commentary appears on our homepage, and this week we have Father Jim Martin talking about the Vatican's surprise decision to reach out to disaffected Anglicans. This is Tim Ree for America Magazine.